Kickstarter started about 3 years ago, three or four years ago, and at least with Supernova papers, they take 3 to 4 years on average. A lot of them take around 5 years. So it's taken us a little while. We're actually ahead of the curve. So I'm going to talk in pretty general terms, and it's going to get more and more technical as it goes on. But I'll probably use various lingo, so anytime you don't understand, please just stop me. Okay. Now, this is just a general motivation. So we now know, we've seen multiple lines of evidence that the universe is accelerating. We have very little clue why it's accelerating. You know, we know that there's this dark energy, but we don't know what it is. So the onus is kind of on observers to just try to learn something more about this acceleration, to measure it in some way better so we could give some insight into its source. What I'm going to talk about today first is just what we think we know about dark energy and why we use type 1a supernovae, a particular kind of supernova, to best measure what dark energy is. I'm going to talk about how we analyze the PanSTARRS data set and our first results. I'll then talk about how we can combine the PanSTARRS measurements with other measurements, like from WMAP or Planck or BAO, and you start getting this interesting tension, and I'll discuss what I think that is. Then I'll possibly depress you about how hard it's going to be over the next 5 or 10 years. And after depressing you, I'll try picking you back up and saying it's actually going to be okay, because we'll hopefully get past these systematics. And I'll talk about conclusions in future work. Okay, so this, you guys all know, we have a basic picture of the universe. We know dark energy is about 70-ish percent. Matter makes up 27%, and then you have your neutrinos, and we think the universe is basically flat. We can make all sorts of pretty pictures where mass pulls us down, and dark energy is like a balloon that pushes us back up. Now I'm going to keep referring to. I'm going to refer to just a bunch of fundamental parameters. Just want to define them now, just so I can refer to them offhand later in the talk. So H is the Hubble expansion parameter. H naught is the Hubble expansion parameter today. Omega M is the fraction of matter versus the critical density. Omega DE, or I might call it omega lambda, is the fraction of dark energy density. And I'll talk about the equation of state parameter of dark energy, W, which is the pressure over rho c squared. So these are generally the parameters I'll discuss and measurements of these parameters. Okay, so we know that the universe is accelerating. We don't know why. The number one opinion on this is that there's just some cosmological constant that W is minus one. This is like the nothing weighs something idea. The next best idea is that there's some kind of quintessence, or that we don't understand gravity, or there's something totally new that we're going to figure out. I'd really love being here to talk with people that could tell me kind of where we are, since I'm more from the observer angle, and I don't know what people are interested in. I put up this book that just came out by Mario Livio, who works at Johns Hopkins or SGSI. And he was making the point that Einstein's biggest mistake was thinking that he made a mistake when he said possibly that putting in the fudge factor of the cosmological constant was his biggest blunder. Okay, so we, on the theoretical side, we have a ways to go. Now, I want to talk about the observational side. So we use type 1a supernovae, and the reason that we use them is because they are. And people refer to them as standard candles, but they're not really standard candles. They're closer to like these standardizable candles. And what happens is that there's a white dwarf, and it accretes matter from its companion. It gets close to the Chandrasekhar limit, and then it explodes. And these explosions are very, very similar. We still don't know what the companion is. This is a big topic today in astronomy. Is its companion another white dwarf, or is it some other kind of star? We are not sure, but we found that if we look at their light curves, basically how much they explode over time, then you could standardize these and you could correct their brightness for how fast they kind of get brighter and then fade away. And also you can correct for what color you see of these supernova light curves. And after you do this, you get their luminosities similar to 10%. And once the luminosity is similar to 10%, then you could use them as these kind of standard candles, because you could say any difference in how bright they look to the observer is actually just due to distance. And this allows you to measure distance for various redshifts. So it's a really powerful probe. Now, I put up this supernova. This is a kind of exciting one. This happened just recently. Probably a lot of you have heard about this. So this was 2014 J in M82. This is like the closest supernova in closest type 1A supernova in 30 years. So it's 11 million light years away. You can actually see it with binoculars at some point. Now, it's actually a pretty interesting supernova. It's a normal type 1A supernova that we would use for cosmology, except that it's very, very red, so there's just a lot of dust in front of it. Yeah?
Sorry, why, if you look at the before and after, it's not just the supernova, it's different, some of the other things look quite
red
too.
It's a good point. So this is something that makes observing supernova kind of difficult. So this image is a bit brighter than this, so you can see like this star is just brighter, and just because they have different exposures have different exposure times, so they're different. So you have to, when we do this is kind of getting into the technical weeds, but you have to scale them to be exactly alike, so everything will cancel out except for this one supernova. But so one of the things that we don't quite understand about supernovae, and I'll talk about later, is how to correct for the dust that's near the supernova. And because this supernova that just exploded is so dusty, we're hoping that can provide a lot of leverage on how to understand the relationship between dust and luminosity. And I'll talk about that later in the talk.
This would be just one example, so how would this teach you about other supernovae?
Oh, so I just bring this up because it just happened a few weeks ago and everyone's excited about it. But the number of supernovae that I'm going to talk about is in the hundreds, soon to be thousands, and soon to be 100,000. So, this is just an example. Okay, so kind of to go over the main lines of why we use them. So these supernovae are standardizable candles. Their intrinsic luminosity is known to about 10%, and their apparent luminosity is what we measure. We measure how bright we see them. And we could take the ratio of the two, and that could provide the luminosity distance. You know what luminosity should be, you see what you measure, you take the ratio, you get a distance out. And also for these supernovae, you can measure the redshift. We can measure just lines in their spectra. And then we have a redshift and we have a distance. So then every single type 1A supernova that we measure can be used to get to put on the Hubble diagram. So we have a redshift and a distance, and each one of those is a measurement of distance at a given redshift. So this is different than like baryon acoustic oscillations, where you kind of need to average over a lot of measurements of galaxies. Here, every single supernova that you measure, you can get cosmology from it. It is a direct measurement of the expansion of the universe. That's right. Yeah, and we can see it's fairly constant with redshift, that this scatter is the same as you go to higher and higher redshift. What is past that 10% is something I'll talk about later, but it seems like there's just some scatter of 10% that is just there, and just supernovae can only be standardized to this amount. And that's as good as it gets. Right, yeah, so We are now correcting for effects populations or metallicity. We think that even past that, so that's before the 10%. So after we correct for those kinds of things, then we get to the 10%. But that's an area that everyone's excited about, or everyone was very excited about a few years ago, and I think they're getting less excited now because it seems like various characteristics of the host galaxy or things like that will only get us so far. But we are looking at that, and we do correct for that. And it seems like scatter is still there past that. Okay. So just in general, so we can't fully explain how supernovae came to be. We don't know what their progenitors are. We can't simulate their explosions yet. And we don't have a good theory of what dark energy could be, so I am going to talk about everything in between. And hopefully, over time, we're going to get these poles. But we actually can do a lot between these two poles.
Is it determined from? I guess is it determined from the cosmological population, from the actual scatter on the DLDZ curve, or is it determined by local?
Is there a local
guys where you can independently?
So it's both at this. So you could do it just for all local supernovae, and you see this scatter that can be reduced to 10%, or you could do it versus DLDZ, and you get the same thing. But it's because we could do it close and nearby, so you could take out any cosmological effect. So we're confident that. That scatter is there, and it's not something we're introducing some way with some prior in any sense. Yep.
The fact that you know it up to 10%, is that an empirical evidence, or because explosion and you say...
That's empirical, yeah. So most of what we do with supernovae are empirical. Since we can't model it very well, most of what we know is just... Here's what we found. You know, we could correct for these characteristics, but here's as good as it gets. So there's right now, other than the fact that they should be standardizable in some sense because all these white dwarfs will reach the Chandrasekhar limit, that kind of provides the motivation that we could use them, but then everything else is empirical after that. Okay. So today I'm mostly going to talk about two papers that just came out. These are pan-STARRS results. You can see all my collaborators here. These are very big groups. You can see Armin Rest led the cosmological constraints from the measurements of type 1a supernovae, and I did the systematic uncertainties. At this point, systematic uncertainties are kind of like the name of the game because, as you'll see, we've really reached a systematic limit. So whenever a supernova paper comes out, you have to have these two papers together. This kind of the way it's done at this point. All right, I just want to give a sense of the numbers of what we can expect in the surveys that have done work so far. So these are a lot of acronyms, but you can see that we're kind of in this middle generation where the number of supernovae that we're using in our samples has kind of gone from 1,000, which we have now, so that has like, when. The SDSS, the Sloan, and SLNS, the Supernova Legacy Survey. And now we're getting to about 10,000 supernovae. And we're about 10-ish years away from 100,000 supernovae. So these are lots and lots of supernovae. We're starting to get big statistics and can slice it and dice it in a lot of different ways. Now, at the same time, or starting this year, the Dark Energy Survey is going. And pan-STARRS in a lot of ways is kind of like the precursor to DES. I guess that got cut off a little bit. Yeah. In a kind, more or less, but you still have that intrinsic scatter that doesn't go with.
Part of the random because if there are two populations. And no matter how many supernovae you have, you just have two populations.
Right.
And
so we think that there's definitely some correlations in there. And also, even as our statistics are getting better and better, our systematics aren't. And that's what I'm going to talk about very shortly. And that's not going away. So we're at the level where our statistics have met our systematics. And another jump, we're just dominated by systematics. So my screen's a little bit cut off. You can see a comparison between pan-STARRS and DES. Actually, pretty similar. The Dark Energy Survey will go deeper. The pan-STARRS survey goes wider, so they get very similar numbers. Their seeing is the same. They had different objectives. So the pan-STARRS was funded for most part by the Air Force to find killer asteroids, and that kind of set how we did a lot of different things and was problematic in various ways. DES is their goal is to measure dark energy, so they're lucky. We found asteroids. I don't know how killer they were. they could kill something. I'm sure. So it was not all for naught. But so I'll be working on dark energy survey as soon as I go to Chicago. But these are the two main experiments that are now the best measurements of dark energy. You can see the Pan-STARRS telescope. Oh, so yeah, dark, I think any new survey that comes up needs to have a Facebook page. So that's really when that's why Pan-STARRS has had its most difficulties. It's because we have not had a Facebook page to document everything. Okay. Now this is the order of operations for doing a supernova study. So first you discover supernovae and you spectroscopically identify them. Second, you do the photometry and the calibration. You measure how bright they are, and you make sure that your filters are all calibrated in the right way, so you can see exactly how good your measurements are. Then you're gonna fit your light curves. You get a light curve of how bright your supernovae are with time. You fit them with your light curve fitter to then get distances out of them. And then once you have distances and redshifts, you can solve for cosmology. And then after that, you think about everything that could go wrong. And steps 1 through 5 are now pretty easy, and you know, in packages, step 6 is really what's difficult. Okay, so to give you a sense of the numbers of supernovae that we found. In Pan-STARRS, we found about 4,000 likely supernovae, so this is a big jump now. And what's difficult is that we can only spectroscopically identify 400 of them. So there's only one kind of supernova that can be used to do real good cosmology studies, and that is this type 1a supernova. And to determine that a supernova is a type 1a supernova, you conventionally need the spectrum. So the spectrum will say it has certain absorption lines, and only a type 1a supernova will have those lines, and then you can say, okay, it's definitely a type 1a supernova. But getting spectra of these distant objects takes resources or time, and the places with big telescopes don't want to give it to these huge supernova surveys anymore because we're just confirming the same things, and hasn't everyone already done this? So we've only spectroscopically confirmed about 10% of them, and we're now moving into this. Because all we're saying, we're basically giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down to these objects, whereas if you compare that to someone else's proposal that says we're learning some new cool thing about this particular galaxy, it's hard. And there have been so many proposals for type 1a supernovae that, and it's not like we're saying we're going to do something new. We do need the statistics, but I wish you were on the tack. Yes. I mean, it doesn't fly so much anymore. It's gotten worse every year to this point that it almost doesn't happen. There's like the second or third. One of the other arguments that people give against giving time is that we think we could do a lot of this photometrically. So if we just have the light curve of the supernova, then maybe we don't even need to confirm it. Maybe we could say this looks enough like a type 1a supernova light curve that we're confident enough and we don't need to be sure. Now, there's lots of people in our field. Right. Yeah. So there's people that think that we could just do this totally photometrically in some Bayesian approach. There's a lot of people that don't think that, or that think that you're throwing away good information. With Pan-STARRS, we got 10%. With Dark Energy Survey, they're going to get something closer to like 1 or 2%. The Dark Energy people I've heard have say it's actually good for them that they're not getting any because they're forced then to do it completely in one way. Whereas we will say, well, you need some kind of representative sample. It's not ideal, but it's the situation we're in right now.
Does the time of follow-up that you need depend on the filter at all that you're using?
Not so much. So it basically takes an hour per object. So if you think that that we have 4,000, that's 4,000 hours, which is that's as much as a telescope has. So to try to actually go with the statistics, it really is asking a lot, and it's hard to do. So I wish it was better, but we are where we are right now. So we've spectroscopically identified 400 type 1a supernovae, and the first paper that we've put out is just with a small sample. So we looked at 150 of these supernovae, and 110 of them or 112 of them are cosmologically useful. Basically, we need a good light curve to then be able to get a distance out of them. So if the light curve only has a rise but no decline, or a decline but no rise, then you can't use it. So that's why you have to cut it. And one of the hopes now is that even though we weren't able to confirm what these supernovae were, you still need a redshift. So we're now going back and getting all the redshifts of the host galaxies that these supernovae were in. So then you could get that redshift, and that saves you from a lot of problems. You still don't know for sure that it was a type 1a supernova, but at least you can have a redshift and you can have a distance. And then the rest you could do in some kind of Bayesian type way. See, this is just a clip from the web pages we have with PanSTARRS. We just track. So we're looking at as much sky as we can cover, and you're subtracting our template sky, so like sky from 2 years ago, from our image last night. And if something pops up, it's a good chance that it's a supernova, and we'll track it. And if it has some kind of light curve like this, good chance it's a type 1a supernova. Yep.
You said you have 1 hour, but you get the
full light curve. So 1 hour to get a spectrum. Uh-huh. So light curve you need to get over a month in multiple filters. So the light curve we get as part of the survey, the spectrum you need to get from someone else. Okay. So just to give you a sense of kind of how quick we see them, so we catch them about 10 days before they peak. So the earliest I think anyone's ever caught one of these is like minus 20 days. So right when they just start to explode. This is redshift here, that's the Z. So you can see that we get to redshift about 0.6. With our next papers, we'll get further, but mostly around redshift 0.3, which is actually a good redshift for trying to measure a lot of models of dark energy. The last panel just shows that we measure these supernovae across our focal plane. It's not so important for this. But you can see that we have a tough selection bias because we can't spectroscopically confirm our whole supernova sample. We end up only spectroscopically confirming the brighter end of our supernovae, because that's what we could get the time for. So we get time from these small telescopes, and so we could confirm the brighter guys, and then we miss out on all these fainter guys, and that leads to a Malmquist bias. If you're only selecting the brighter candidates, that could bias your cosmology in some way. So we need to solve over that. Okay. Now, the thing that I hear a lot of people say about type 1a supernovae and using it for figuring out what dark energy is that we're dominated by calibration errors. And that is certainly true right now, but I'm going to hope to show that this is going to get better soon. So basically what we do is, for calibration, you need to basically say that your measurements through your filters are as correct as possible, and they matter on an absolute scale. So a lot of parts of astronomy are relative. You just measure this measurement to this measurement. But for type 1a supernovae exclusively, you actually care about their absolute flux. And what we know that the Hubble Space Telescope has the best absolute flux system because it's in space and it doesn't have to worry about atmosphere. So we tie our calibration system to them. And what we could also do is compare our calibration to the calibration of other surveys like Sloan, SDSS. And what I'm showing here is this is along our focal plane. So imagine you have this big mirror. The differences compared to Sloan for different fields. So MD is different parts of the sky, and then across our focal plane. So you can see that there's some small deviations across our focal plane, and there's differences for each field on the level of about 1%. But these levels on the order of 1% are coherent, or they're correlated, and any kind of correlated errors become problematic. It doesn't change so much over the time of night. The bigger problem is actually just over the history of our observations. So over the 3 years, it changes a lot. Over a night, we can mostly take out those zero points that change over, along the day, along the night. So any kind of hour by hour change, we take out by, we could take out the atmospheric effects or how good the seeing is. But if our filters degrade or our mirrors change over time a little bit, that part's tougher.
Sharp way of saying that, okay, So like, tonight is like 5 degrees warmer than last night. So
right. So most of that just comes out as a zero point. So basically, it just means that your observations this hour are this much brighter than your observations at this point. So to like first through third order, that's true. You could take it as a zero point, but something like what you're saying can manifest itself in it changes the colors of stars a little bit, or has these kind of couple percent errors, and those are harder. We're not there yet, but those shouldn't correlate with supernova distances or the supernova measurements, because those should be pretty random. So they shouldn't be that big of a systematic. But
disappear as well.
Well, yeah, but when I say we calibrate to Hubble, it's more like our overall calibration system is tied. So night by night should be, but we still may have some night to night problems. So because night to night's calibrated to our overall system, which is calibrated to HST, so it should all interconnect if we're doing everything right. And I'll talk more about that later. But basically, we measure these light curves. So this is what I mean by a light curve. You see the measurements get brighter and then fade away versus time. And then you can fit these light curves with some kind of light curve fitter. And from the light curve fitter, you get out a distance. So here I'm showing three different supernovae at different redshifts and in different filters. And you use the different filters to get colors, and you measure the decline rate of these light curves. And from that, you could get a distance. Okay. So that's what I was just saying before. So we get a color and what we typically call a stretch. That's how fast the light curve declines. And we get a distance. And then we determine how these parameters. So basically the color of the light curve and how fast it declines correlates with luminosity. So we do that also empirically. And then we get a distance. So basically, we can measure how fast all these light curves decline and measure one parameter, but then we still need to know how that one parameter correlates with distance. And we could then look at that for all of our supernovae and kind of try to empirically fit that out. So there's still a big empirical component to this. It's not motivated by theory in some way. So the fits are calibrated back to some subsample of light curves we got 5 years ago. So it's not from simulations of light curves. It's calibrated to actual light curves when we fit them. Yeah. Okay. So ultimately, then, so here's where we're starting to get into more cosmology. Ultimately, when you get a distance out of these light curves, then you make a Hubble. This is what we call a Hubble diagram, and you're plotting. Here I'm plotting, say, the luminosity distance versus redshift on top. This is kind of a typical Hubble diagram, and then I'm showing residuals, basically versus a lambda CDM universe. So I just take out the solid curve, and what we need to do is you need to add in a Loci sample, because when you're trying to do cosmology, then relative measurements actually come into play. Basically, you care about how bright your type 1a supernovae are at higher redshifts compared to your low redshifts, and any kind of deviations you could attribute to cosmology. So you need to have a really big Loci sample to do this. So this is kind of the big thing that we get to this Hubble diagram, and then you can start looking at different models of the universe. So here I'm showing three different models, one which is our lambda CDM model, one where we have no dark energy, and one where we also have no dark energy, but we have omega matter of one. And you can see that we can separate these models pretty well.
Did you have issues where, say, the low Z sample comes from galaxies which are more chemically enriched by virtue of them being slightly altered in some sort of?
Yeah, so yes, great question. That is a huge problem, and
especially for us. That's a really big systematic for us, because we just have pan-STARRS and low Z. If we had other samples that go out to this redshift, or we had some other sample that was like pan-STARRS at similar redshifts, then that gets diluted a bit. But this is especially problematic also because the way Loci surveys were done where they just targeted really bright galaxies, whereas PanSTARRS targeted anything in the sky. And if bright galaxies correlate with different kinds of luminosity, which I point to supernovae, it's problematic. So we have a big systematic for that, and that's something that we're going to have to beat down, but right now it's a big thorn in our side. So yeah, that's it. That one's a doozy. Okay. Now, I kind of want to make the point that measuring, so the way these Hubble diagrams are typically shown is you have these three models of the universe, and the difference in luminosity distance that you see is on the order of 20-ish percent. And this is easy at this point for us. Trying to say that we're in this regime where you have omega m of 0.3 and omega dark energy of 0.7 compared to these other models, that's pretty easy to see. So what people typically show when they look at supernovae, we've kind of passed this point. And in this model, I'm fixing W of minus one. But now we're starting to do cooler things. We can start asking tougher questions. And if we want to say, how can we measure W to 10%, then the differences that you expect are on the order of, you know, a few percent or so. And trying to say then which model our measurements favor is getting to be a lot tougher. And what I kind of want to talk about now is how can we get to this stage where we can start separating these various models of changes in W of 10%. And because this is now where all the interesting tension is W minus 1.1 versus minus 1. And you can see that a good amount of this is going to be, a good amount could get better with statistics, but if there's any systematic that is on this level of a few percent, then we're screwed for now. So for this, it depends what you marginalize over. So like for this plot, I'm just fixing the matter density, but you could, like typically what I show, and I'll show in just a couple slides, is you plot like W versus omega M, or W versus omega lambda, or omega lambda versus omega M. So typically you have two parameters, but you could just marginalize over another one of them. But yeah, typically it is. Right, so I'm not going to show any W, not WA plots in this. We're getting there, but because we don't go to that high redshifts, we're going to need to combine with another sample. And the point with this paper was just to kind of focus on PanSTARRS, so we haven't done that yet, but that's something we're going to do very soon. But yeah, it's right there. Black is the bind. Right, yeah. So you could, I mean, you could see by eye that maybe you see some kind of trends, but it could just be noise. And it's hard to tell now, and that's why we need to get better.
Or should I really expect you to get W better than 10%?
Right. So you mean there's 10% in the stack. Right. Well, that should be fairly constant, and that shouldn't have any directional dependence, right? It shouldn't just make all these supernovae go brighter in this way. So that should just add scatter, pretty much. So if it is what we think it is, I don't think that will be a problem because it shouldn't change with redshift. Is what I'm trying to say. Yep.
To produce a favored result. For example, there's something called decision, boosted decision tree algorithm.
Okay.
And it's good for you for data like that to get a favored result, a likelihood test. It's okay. Called a likelihood test.
Okay, so I'll show some likelihood plots here with the boosted decision. Okay, I'll look that up. Right, yeah. Because I know one problem with this is you can be susceptible to just large outliers. Like if there's one measurement that goes wrong, yeah, it can be problematic. But right, that I'll have to learn more about. Okay. Well, if you look at most of these Hubble diagrams, you It looks jagged. Like everyone's first impression, this is always surprisingly jagged. But you actually get good constraints. I mean, you do expect there to be noise, and when you look at noise, a lot of times your eye can see some kind of structure, and sometimes the structure is real and sometimes isn't. But Hubble diagrams are jagged, and with statistics, chances are that the jaggedness will go down. But I'll definitely look that up. Okay. Yep. I can't say it's totally blind. We got to the Hubble, like we looked at this Hubble diagram, and to this point it wasn't blind. And just to make sure that our points generally were in agreement with our low Z sample, but we didn't look at our whatever cosmology we're getting. So I know that there's some groups that really pride themselves on how blind they are, and I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. I'm using SALT 2. So MLCS was written by my advisor, so I have nothing against it. The problem with MLCS is that it actually has a lot of really good components. It just hasn't had much effort over the last 5 years, whereas there's been a lot of people that worked on SALT 2. But they make different fundamental assumptions, and I actually think the MLCS assumptions were just as good, if not better, than the SALT 2 assumptions. SALT 2 does things more empirically. It just says we don't know anything about what supernova light curves look like and how they correlate with distances. We're just going to say everything's empirical. Whereas MLCS assumes more about the dust and reddening, and actually, I think I personally prefer that approach. It hasn't been updated. It's like an old iPhone right now, where SALT 2 is like the newest iPhone. But that old iPhone's still great, and I like it a lot. It's like a BlackBerry, right? BlackBerry's great. Okay. Now I want to get to systematics, and this is where things start getting really difficult. So I'm showing here. Basically a bunch of different Hubble diagrams, and this is just for the pan-STARRS and low Z sample. And for each panel that you see here, I'm changing one of our systematics by one sigma. So if I take just in the top left, for the pan-STARRS G-band, I'm saying, what if our G-band measurement was off by one sigma? What if our one sigma is like 1%? Basically, what if how much, if you measure in the G-band a supernova to be 23.5 megs, then what if it's actually 23.49 typically, and everything was just correlated, it's off by 1%. Then how does that then propagate to changes in distances? And you can see in that top left, I'm just putting this in cosmology terms. So the blue is changes in W of 5%, and this is versus redshift. And you can see if I change the G band, all our measurements by 1%, that could actually give you something like changes of 2 to 3-ish% in W. And then you could start looking across for each one of these. So here's pan-STARRS GRIZ, the different filters that we measure it in, our selection bias, if we're just preferring brighter candidates versus the fainter candidates, if there's some kind of peculiar velocity that affects our low Z supernovae, if there's something we don't understand about supernova color, HST CalSpec system, this is saying if when we tie our calibration to HST, if HST can be screwed up in some way. This one is if the Milky Way extinction values that we get are actually off by what they think is their one sigma, or if there's something wrong with their SALT 2 light curve fitter. You can see that in a lot of these different systematics, just by one sigma, then you are getting these changes in W by 5%. So these are going to add in quadrature, so it's not going to be just this 5 plus this 5 plus this 5. It'll be square root of 5 squared plus 5 squared plus 5 squared. But you can see kind of now where we are with our top systematics, how bad they are. So you can see that a lot of them are on this order of 5%, and we need to start beating all of these down. So when I say that our measurements of W are accurate to 10 or 15%, you can see how these systematics are going to really provide this systematic floor, and that this is what's getting very tough for us at this point. So this is the I think the most depressing thing I could show you, because it shows kind of how difficult things are. But I'm actually pretty encouraged by it. Now, a lot of these can just be beat down by doing better calibration. So in arrows here, I show which of these are just due to problems with calibration. So that's Panzer GRIZ, the HST CalSpec system. Actually, the Sawtooth Light Curve Fitter, its biggest problems are also due to calibration. So if we can somehow use HST's calibration system better, or HST improves it more, or we do some kind of better intercalibration between our various surveys, then we could beat this down. And that'll take out a large chunk of it. Some of these other ones, like Milky Way extinction, this is basically how well we can model dust throughout our universe. That likely will get better. Supernova color is something that will get better as we observe more about more supernovae and try learning more in different ways about their color and how it relates to reddening. But a lot of these are ones that we should be able to beat down over time. So even though this is kind of as bad as it gets, I'm very, very optimistic that a lot of these will get significantly better in the next few years, and we'll be able to beat them down. Okay, so if we then have all of our systematic uncertainties, what I do is I put them into a systematic covariance matrix so that you can propagate them fully. And in purple, I'm showing our constraints on W versus omega M with only statistical uncertainties. And then basically we add the systematic covariance matrix in. And in red, I'm showing the statistical and systematic uncertainties. And you can see here our constraints for W versus omega M from our PanSTARRS and low Z results. So our systematic error matrix will basically make our contours bigger. And they actually have the effect of moving our contours slightly because they'll weight the errors on our different distance measurements. And then the cosmology that we quote in our papers will just be the marginalized value of W and omega M. So that's how we include our systematic error matrix. So now I want to get to the fun stuff. We can then combine our constraints. So in purple and blue, I'm showing our constraints from PanSTARRS and Type 1a supernova. We combine them with Planck or other measurements, which I'll soon talk about. And we can start saying what we think is our values for the fundamental properties of the universe. So we can combine just with Planck. Planck is here in yellow. Orange is the overlap between these two constraints. And you can see we get omega m of 0.35 plus or minus 0.05 if we assume that W is minus 1, or if we assume that if we assume flatness, if we combine our PanSTARRS measurements with Planck, we get a W of minus 1.12 plus or minus 0.09, and that includes all of our systematic errors. So that is all included. So that's, you know, 1.5-ish or a little less than 1.5-ish tension with W minus 1 when we combine with Planck. Right.
But it seems like you're still doing quite well in breaking this degeneracy.
Right.
Right. So better in breaking that degeneracy, but not in breaking that.
Right. It's just because that the changes in W really come about at lower redshift. And the changes in omega m you can measure better at higher redshift. So these supernova measurements provide really good constraints at W because it can measure this low redshift well, whereas you're high red and it can as well. So that's why supernovae remain kind of the premier tool to do this. So baryonic acoustic oscillations also can. The problem is you just don't have much volume at these low redshifts, so you just can't have many galaxies. So I think that supernovae will remain the best way at this, just because we can cover this low redshift and any low redshift deviations. Like if you follow these two different W curves out, basically this difference doesn't get bigger as you go to higher redshift. So the big change in W is really happening around Z of 0.5 or so. So any kind of different W model that you're measuring, the best place to measure a lot of times is at Z of 0.5. Okay. All right, so now we could then start, we could start comparing our constraints with other joint measurements. So on the top, I show what I just showed, that's Planck plus type 1a supernovae. On the right, I'm showing Planck plus Baryon-Akusa oscillations plus type 1a supernovae. Then on the bottom, I show Planck plus H-naught plus type 1a supernovae, and then Planck plus BAO plus H-naught plus type 1a supernovae. So the tension that we see with W minus 1 is somewhere between 1 and 3 sigma. And you can see that it really kicks in when we include H-naught with Planck. So probably a lot of you have heard about this tension in cosmology between the Cepheid measurement of H-naught and Planck's version measurement of H-naught. And one way to understand this is that when you combine them, it really favors a low value of W, so close to 3 sigma value of W. So if you basically what's saying is that if you think that both Planck and H-naught are correct, then we have some kind of new physics, and things are very exciting. The other way to think about it is that one of them is definitely wrong, and so now there's a lot of pointing fingers going on. But you can see that with pan stars, with our type 1 supernovae, we see some tension with Planck. Depends on where you grew up, I guess. If you think 1.5-ish sigma is tension or not. But things get more interesting as you combine more of the probes. In particular, if you combine H-naught with Planck together, then we get this tension. So this is kind of the state of where cosmology is at. And everyone's now trying to say everyone else is wrong because everyone thinks that W is minus 1. And everyone's very scared if they see that a result comes out where W is not minus 1. So the hope is that our supernova measurements can keep getting better and better. And we could tighten this constraint, and that's now what we're trying to do. Yeah, so it is 2 sigma, but when you marginalize it, some kind of funniest things happen, so it looks more like 2.5 sigma, because when I'm just showing W, it's marginalized over omega m, and that's why it comes out as 2 sigma. That I was surprised by that also, and it took me a little while to get convinced of it.
If you look at the lower left, it seems like most of the tension is actually pushing it closer to negative 1.
Yeah, I right. I agree. So when people ask me what I think about the tension, I say that if you like Planck over here and H-naught over here, we're somewhere along the middle. So I think we could kind of go either way, but yeah, you can say that it's pulling a little bit more. And we definitely can't say we favor one over the other. We definitely also can't say we think one is wrong. But I think what was interesting when we did this is that it was kind of one of the first measurements to show just if you make everything try to agree with everything else, then this tension pops up. Yep.
Models, not just a function of time.
Right. So we have not done that yet. So that's kind of next on our list. But we're hoping to have a bigger sample when we attack that. So for now, we just have these kind of this totally simple approach, and then I'll start getting more complex. But there's just a limit to what we are trying to do here. But our constraints, even if we had if we combine every single supernova measurement, our constraints for like WA versus W-naught are still not great, but I think in the next order of magnitude jump, then they'll get better. So we're getting there, but we're not there yet. Right, so a lot of the constraint for WA comes from the higher redshift supernovae, and we don't have that. Right. Yes. So if you're just trying to measure W naught, then if you get to redshift 0.5, that's where you get the most leverage. But if you try getting WA also, then you would think that that probably also changes redshift in some way. So as you get to higher redshifts, you get more leverage there.
I thought the correlating pivot was about Z of 0.5, the W naught WA, the correlation redshift.
You think it's at 0.5?
Can't be sure, but there's a.
I thought it was close to 0.8 or something, but we don't go that high. But
does that depend on the data set?
Yeah.
Yeah, independent of the data set. Right. So the data is getting there. So SNLS goes to higher redshifts, and we also have HST, which goes to Z of 2. So we're gathering together, and soon there'll be one of these samples that just joins everything together. But for now, we kind of tried just sticking to our own thing. So one thing that I want to mention was that this, whatever this tension is that we see with a W of minus 1, it gets smaller if you use WMAP measurements versus Planck measurements. So on the top, I'm showing Planck plus PanSTARRS. Sorry, on the left, I'm showing Planck plus PanSTARRS. And on the right, I'm showing WMAP plus PanSTARRS. And then I add in the other constraints. And you could see that there's basically a change of around 8% for just Planck, or for just WMAP, and 5% if you combine everything else. So these kind of various papers by like Spergel et al. Trying to point out problems about Planck are motivated in a lot of ways by this, because you know this is some significant change, you know, in the order of 5 to 8% that you're seeing whether you take one probe or the other. So we try to be just kind of agnostic in our paper, and we say, here's what you get with Planck, and here's what you get with H-naught.
And once you include PanSTARRS, it seems like regardless of whether you use Planck or WMAP, the total area of the error that is still the same. Like, you know, you haven't degraded your errors. Once you use PanSTARRS, you know, the total.
The errors haven't changed, but if you go from Planck to WMAP, the error is the same, right?
They're similar. They're not exactly the same, but yeah, they're certainly similar. Because it just matters of where the WMAP Planck hits the contour, and also like it's at what omega m it hits your supernova constraint, right? Because just the omega m that Planck or WMAP favors is actually different by 4-ish%.
Because you're still important in breaking the degeneracy.
Right. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. So it matters a lot on where they intersect. Right. Exactly. So this is kind of how you can see the status. So there's hints of tension if you combine with Planck, but a lot of that is being driven by H-naught, the H-naught Planck tension. We also see that if we combine with WMAP versus Planck, then that removes a lot of this tension, even if you do combine with H-naught. So that's why. And, you know, people that are in favor of the Cepheid H-naught measurement like WMAP a lot more than Planck, and there's all sorts of these kinds of. I have not.
Because I mean, WMAP and Planck are essentially the same thing at low L.
Right. Taking both the same at low L.
But then at high L, of course, they're the higher the SPTNI. So I mean, that would be like.
Yeah,
placement basically.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's interesting. Right. Okay. This didn't come out so well, but one thing I just want to point out is that we, let's just say conformation bias, but the thing that we need to be concerned about is conformation bias. So I'm just showing, this is a plot that was in this paper recently by Croft et al. And it's showing omega, lambda, and W naught versus time. And one thing I checked out, I took from the literature all the W naught values that people have measured, and I just plotted the distribution. If you do so, you can see that it is totally not Gaussian, that it's just pretty much like a spike near W of minus 1. So somehow people keep finding their measurements of W very, very close to minus 1, way more than you expect if people's errors are correct. So it should be confirmation bias. Yeah. Sorry. Conformation bias makes sense in some way also, I think, actually. Yeah. But we're still conforming to everything. The point is that there are too many measurements close to W minus 1. Like when we're being asked about how blinded we were actually one of the first measurements to have 1.5 sigma tension with W minus 1. And it's something that I think everyone really needs to worry about at this point, that
we think everyone thinks that the answer ultimately is W is minus one, and they're skewing their results consciously or unconsciously towards that. And it's kind of now's the time that everyone needs to look and make sure that, they're not doing that. Right. It may or may not be a spelling mistake. Yeah. It's both. Okay. Okay. How am I doing with time? Okay. Oh, a couple. Okay. So, okay. I have had a lot else to say. So let me just breeze through a couple things. So I said before that the one of the biggest systematics has to do with calibration, and I'm going to skip over a couple of parts. But basically, now that we want to have really good statistics, we want to combine all these different samples together. So we have PANSTARS, and we have DES, and we're going to have Sloan and SNLS. And to get great statistics, we could stick them all in one pie because we're all just measuring the same kinds of supernovae. Now, instead of trying to tie all of our calibrations to HST, we could say, let's all just tie our calibrations together. We look at a lot of the same fields. So if we measure the same stars in the same way, then we could tie our systems together. Now, there's a really nice paper, this PANSTARS paper by Schlafly and Finkbeiner, and they compared PANSTARS to Sloan, and they looked at any magnitude differences across the sky. So on the y-axis is declination, and the x-axis is RA, and they looked to see if there's any differences, and what came out are these stripes. And what's interesting about that is that Sloan was observed in stripes. So you could see issues with Sloan by basically kind of cross-calibrating PANSTARS with Sloan. So it shows you that the PANSTARS calibration is better than 1%, and we actually can now fix Sloan problems. What we could also do is when we combine Sloan with PANSTARS, we could use the two to cross-calibrate each other and tie their calibrations together and then make this Hubble diagram with Sloan and PANSTARS using this cross-calibration. We could also do nice things like if we know that PANSTARS is consistent across the sky, then we could use PANSTARS to cross-calibrate other surveys. So on the left, I show PANSTARS versus SNLS. So basically in black, I'm showing the differences that we see in SNLS and PANSTARS, and in orange, I'm showing what we would predict if we'd assume that all of our filter functions are right, if we understand our calibration. And you could see that the black is not on the orange. It's off by a couple of percent, which I showed before is a really big systematic. And we could do the same thing with Sloan and PANSTARS. And again, you could see that the black is not on the orange, but it's actually in the other direction. What's particularly interesting about this is that Sloan and SNLS have said that their calibration is tied to better than half a percent. So, but they don't actually overlap in any of their observations. They do these indirect routes. So because PANSTARS overlaps with everything, then we could use PANSTARS to tie other surveys together. And ultimately, this will make like a Uber Cal of supernova samples because PANSTARS looks at every part of the sky. So we can start doing these really neat things. And a lot of this is kind of brute force. Like calibration is a sticky problem, but it can just be beaten down by you observe the same things as what another guy observed, and in this way beat it down. So I won't have a chance to talk about supernova physics, but this is another really tricky one about how supernova color and dust relate to each other and what properties of supernova luminosity relate to their host galaxy. But it involves a lot of Bayesian formalism. It's something I've worked on, and was hoping maybe someone here who's better at Bayesian formalism than me could help out with. So I'm just going to skip over that. And one other final thing that I want to mention is that we're now getting to the stage where we can measure Hubble diagrams at different parts of the sky. So we could look at individual clusters and find a lot of supernovae around those clusters and get a Hubble diagram just near that cluster. And this could help us learn a lot about various growth measurements and things of this nature and use strong lensing, because we know what a typical type 1a supernova Hubble diagram will look like, and any changes in our Hubble diagrams for different parts of the sky could provide some really, really interesting interesting measurements. So in conclusion, it's a very exciting time to work in cosmology. Now that we have all these different cosmological probes, we can start cross-checking each other. And that's where all this kind of tension is coming from now. But I think it's a really fun time. And there's a lot of PanSTARRS work to do. And hopefully PanSTARRS and Dark Energy Survey can help each other out. And I think that it's the time that everyone's kind of joined together. And supernovae should make a lot of progress in the next few years. So that's all I got. Thank you. Yeah.
As you pointed out, it's probably not going to be feasible in the future to follow up every LSST supernova.
Right.
So spectroscopically.
Yeah.
Are there any tests you can do from your sample comparing the photometric sample with the spectroscopic, where you can validate sort of photometry only methods and see whether they actually work?
Yeah. So we could definitely do that. But there's two problems with it. One. Is that
the supernovae that we follow up are typically the brighter ones, and those are the easier ones to figure out what photometrically they are. And the second problem is that you're worried that in your photometric sample, they may just be tied to different host galaxies, which may have some kind of correlation. So we could do, the plan for the Dark Energy Survey was originally that it's gonna confirm a representative sample, so just totally random, every one out of every 1,000 supernovae, it's going to follow up. And that was really good. And then they just didn't get the time to do this, and we're not doing it. But we can look at our spectroscopic samples and say, if they were photometric samples, how good would we do? But it's not the best test, because those are biased samples. So it's a very interesting question. And I've heard people say the million-dollar question is, how to say what the systematic error is on that process. Basically, if we use a spectroscopic sample to say how good our photometric sample is, how do we say how good that is? And no one has come up with a clever way of doing it. But if you have an idea, I'd love to hear it, because that would be a great paper.
If you improve the simulations, will that help at all on the photometric ID, or is that?
So the problem is that the simulations are based on our spectroscopic sample, so it's circular in that sense. We can, with our simulation, simulate low signal to noise, and but you still just don't know what, you still worry that the things that you put into your simulation are biased and not representative. Right, well, we can model dust in some way, but you're always in this kind of circular loop with these simulations. So a lot of people think that with simulations we could get most of the way there, but the question is how to figure out what that remaining part is of what you can't model. Yeah.
Let's consider the possibility that it's 3 sigma wave.
Okay.
How does that affect the angle of power spectrum fit in the CDM?
That's beyond my... Yeah, I'm not sure. I would assume so, but yeah, I'm not. I have not looked at that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think if this tension is real, it'll be cemented the next couple of years. Even if it's not, it'll go away in the next couple of years. So we'll know pretty soon. But yeah, I'm not sure. Yep.
What is the timeline for this? There's 100 or so of these 400 in the family.
Yeah.
Is it the next few hundred
due in some
timeline?
Yeah, probably the next few hundred will be paper out next year, and then the full sample of 4,000 will be 2 to 3 years. The first Dark Energy Survey paper will come out in 3 years also.
So that's when we'll see the next big jump.
Kind of all the errors on things to go with the square root of that. So can you get some big improvements?
Well,
it's a systematic.
Yeah, it depends. It depends how we do the systematic floor. So I think the Dark Energy Survey will make a big jump with all the calibration, and if they can do what they're saying they can do, then we can actually will be statistics limited again. But it's hard to know. People claim great things starting off a survey, and it's hard to know what they actually do.
I was wondering if you could say something about the discrepancy between the two filters. I know you just said that MLSCS
yeah.
is not being used or advanced recently.
Yeah.
But you remember when Rick Kessler put out that paper?
Yes. Yeah.
There was a one sigma discrepancy with the same data set.
Yep.
So has that evolved? This was like 2 years ago.
Right. So this is this is one thing that I want to talk about, but I just didn't have the time. Basically, I'll just say this really quickly. So MLCS assumes that the big difference between MLCS and SALT is that MLCS says that the reddening we see in supernovae should be Milky Way reddening. And SALT says, well, we have no clue. Let's just empirically see the relation between luminosity and reddening, and just whatever that linear relation is what we take. But the problem is that that doing that empirical approach, it could, instead of like, it's linear versus like some kind of Bayesian approach, and you could bias yourself in some way. So we know that there's a scatter that we see in distances, and there's been this question of what it's due to, and ultimately everyone's kind of said that it's due to just this luminosity variation, it's like achromatic. But if instead you say that it's a chromatic variation, that it's due to supernova color being different supernova to supernova, then what you actually can get out is beta is like R sub V of 3.1. Basically, if you say that all the scatter that you see in supernovae is actually due to color versus luminosity, then you get out the Milky Way reddening law. So it just depends on that scatter that you see in supernovae, what you attribute it to. And it turns out that if you say it's due to color, then the reddening law that comes out of that is the Milky Way reddening law, which is what MLCS said originally. So that's why I was saying that I'm actually a proponent of the MLCS approach, but there's just little bits of problems with like just how MLCS was trained that needs to be updated. And once it happens, I do think the MLCS methodology is stronger, but it just needs a big dust off.
So there are no recent comparisons like that one of the same data set?
There have been kind of recent, but no one has updated MLCS enough to get rid of the little problems that Rick Kessler pointed out. So actually, I think the big differences, I really like MLCS on, but the little things that Rick Kessler pointed out do need to be fixed before a good comparison is made. So yeah, so like Saurabh Jha is talking about this 3 or 2K3. But 2K2 is still the top of the line as far as this goes. And I'm excited that someone works this out because MLCS is very powerful.
Dinner in the bistro at 6 p.m. and everyone is welcome to join. So
thank you, everybody.